This is Fresh Air. I'm Marty Moscowane. The Tutsi rebel army has declared an end to the civil war in Rwanda, and yesterday they named a new government. This rapid change of events in Rwanda has radically shifted the country's balance of power, with the minority Tutsis now in control. Millions of Hutus are fleeing Rwanda into Zaire, and relief organizations there are completely overwhelmed. The Tutsis were last in control in Rwanda in the late 1950s, when the country was a Belgian colony. After independence in 1962, the majority Hutus took over in a bloody uprising, and many Tutsis fled to Uganda. It is these expatriate Tutsis who make up most of the rebel army, the Rwandan Patriotic Front. They began their moves into Rwanda in 1990 and forced the government into signing a power-sharing accord last year. The mass slaughter of Tutsis and opposition Hutus in Rwanda over the past few months was a desperate attempt by extremist Hutus to stop this move towards power sharing. We've invited journalist Frank Smythe to provide some background on the situation. Smythe has been covering Rwanda for The Nation, The New Republic, and The Village Voice, and he's an investigator for Africa Watch. I asked him what the Rwandan Patriotic Front wants.
The RPF was looking primarily for the right of repatriation to Rwanda. These are these expatriate Tutsi refugees have been living outside Rwanda for the past several decades. So their primary goal was to earn the right of repatriation to Rwanda so that people, their own Tutsi families, would then have the right of returning to Rwanda and hopefully the right to gain some land. That is why Hutu forces feared them and didn't want the Tutsi to return, because the Tutsi had dominated Rwanda. They were the major landowners up until the late 1950s, when they were violently overthrown. So at bottom, this was really a struggle over land.
Did they want to play a part in the government, or were they more interested in getting land back?
I think the rank-and-file fighters were interested primarily in getting land back, but the Tutsi leadership certainly was interested in playing a role in the government. Their problem is although they were militarily superior to Rwanda's Hutu government, they found themselves in a position where if they tried to seize power, something I think they could have done militarily, they still would have represented, the Tutsis in Rwanda would have represented no more than 14% of the total population. So no matter what they did militarily, they would eventually be forced to share power in some way with Hutu. So I think their other goal in terms of the war was to achieve a negotiated settlement.
Now, there were some peace accords that were signed in August of 1993. These are the Arusha Accords, is that right?
That's right.
What was signed back then?
The Arusha Accord was a very good agreement, which would have ended hostilities between the Tutsi guerrillas and the Rwandan government. It provided a formula for power sharing in which the president's cabinet would have been divided equally between his own ruling party officials as well as Hutu opposition parties, which have been a third force throughout this whole conflict, as well as the representatives of the Tutsi guerrillas. But what happened on August 6th is that there were forces loyal to the who had been part of the president's government who were opposed to this peace plan and thought the president had gone too far in his reconciliation. According to Belgium, these forces are responsible for then assassinating the president, then sending the presidential guard soldiers to slaughter the Hutu opposition along with their, in most cases, spouses and children. And then their ruling party radio then incited Hutu masses and militias to then begin what amounts now to a genocidal slaughter against Tutsi.
Is the current fighting in Rwanda a struggle then between Hutus and Tutsis? Can we understand it in those rather simple terms?
Well, I think that's too simple, but certainly that's an element. I think there's been a lot of discussion about whether or not this is a political war or a tribal war, with people taking very firm positions on both sides of the spectrum. And I think that it's both. It's impossible to separate the two. What you had here was an historic ethnic or tribal animosity between the Hutu and Tutsi for several centuries, rooted in the fact that there was a shortage, has always been a shortage of land in Rwanda. The Tutsi monarchy dominated Rwanda for three centuries before the Hutu violently overthrew them in 1959, killing anywhere from 20 to 100,000 Tutsi. And that slaughter was described then by Bertrand Russell, the philosopher, as the most systematic and horrible massacre the world had witnessed had witnessed to that date since the slaughter of the Jews by the Nazis. So certainly Rwanda has a precedent for this kind of violence, and this ethnic or tribal hatred, whatever you want to call it, is real. What happened since then is Hutu have been in power ever since. The Tutsi in Rwanda have been marginalized, and in addition, the Tutsi refugees of this first slaughter have been marginalized in neighboring countries, most of them being concentrated in Uganda. What happened when they came back in 1990 in the form of an invasion force, a lot of the Hutu peasants, I believe, had the impression that this would mean, if the Tutsi were to take power, a restoration of the Tutsi monarchy, a restoration of the Tutsi landowning class, and ultimately the displacement of most Hutu in the country.
Frank Smyth is our guest on Fresh Air today. He's a freelance journalist and an investigative consultant to Human Rights Watch ARMS Project, and we're talking about the current situation in Rwanda. You're the author of a report called Arming Rwanda. This was a report you did for Human Rights Watch. Who has been arming Rwanda over the last decades?
Well, over the last decades, historically, Rwanda got most of its weapons from Belgium, Belgian FAL, as well as some German G3 automatic rifles. And Belgium, of course, is Rwanda's former colonial ruler. But what happened in 1990 when the war started with the invasion of Rwanda from Uganda of Tutsi guerrillas is that Belgium has an explicit policy against providing any lethal aid or arms to a country at war. So Belgium continued to provide training and non-lethal arms, but cut off all arms deliveries to Rwanda. France, on the other hand, when it saw this was taking place, feared that that could result in Rwanda being overthrown by the Tutsi guerrillas. And while Rwandans identify the conflict largely in terms of Hutu and Tutsi, France identified the conflict in terms of English-speaking Tutsi guerrillas backed by English-speaking Uganda and a French-speaking government with which France had a military cooperation agreement. So France then, in 1990, became Rwanda's main military patron, and much of the weapons came from France.
In terms of who was armed, the Hutus got most of the supplies?
The Hutus got most of the supplies, although the Tutsi guerrillas are also very well armed. Some of the weapons that they claim to have stolen from Uganda include Katusha Soviet-made multiple rocket launchers, which can cover an area wider and longer than a soccer field with a concentration of incoming fire. So certainly, I would say that both sides are very well armed.
Now, the Rwandan rebels have claimed victory, and they say they want to install a new government. What kind of government do they have in mind?
That's a very good question, and that is the basic question for the future of Rwanda. They claim that they are interested in forming a multi-party and multi-ethnic government, and that is necessary for the future stability of Rwanda, and the Tutsi guerrillas need to be encouraged and pushed by the international community to make that the case. The problem is that a great deal of the moderate Hutu opposition was murdered in Rwanda, although there are some people who have survived and some political leaders who have survived who need to be cultivated and incorporated into this power-sharing agreement. The other thing that's going to be necessary to make this government work would be to bring those Hutu extremists from the Rump government, the previous government responsible for the genocide, to find a mechanism to bring them to trial in an international forum to discourage the Tutsi guerrillas as well as Tutsi fighters from exacting retribution on their own. For the future of Rwanda, the big question is, how are you going to get Hutus to believe that the Tutsi guerrillas are not out for revenge and are going to kill them? And likewise, how are you going to reassure Tutsi civilians, the survivors, that they can return to Rwanda?
Well, that's what the Rwandan rebels have said, that everyone's safety will be guaranteed. There will not be reprisals against the populace. Can they be believed when they say that?
I think the only thing that is going to convince both Tutsi and Hutu civilians in Rwanda that either side is not going to exact retribution is to stabilize the situation, and I think it may require the deployment of UN peacekeepers for some time, or OAU peacekeepers with the support of the UN, to give civilians the idea that this is, that you no longer have to fear from guerrillas or bands of roving Hutu militias, that there will be some visibly neutral armed force in Rwanda that can maintain some kind of order and prevent these revengeful killings.
The Tutsis have, they killed an archbishop in the past. Their past is not perfectly clean, is it?
Absolutely not. In the beginning, before this crisis, from 1990 to 1993, the Tutsi guerrillas were responsible for a number of human rights abuses, especially the execution of civilians that they accused of collaborating with the government, as well as the summary executions of military prisoners. In addition, there's credible evidence that they forcibly dislocated hundreds, if not thousands, of civilians and forced an unknown number of them, certainly hundreds, it seems, into slave labor. The murder of the archbishop was a horrendous crime. And certainly the RPF will have to answer for it. If there is an international tribunal held, then that's one of the crimes that also would have to be investigated.
You said that the RPF is relatively small, what, 12,000, 15,000 people?
That's right.
How has a group that small been able to basically be victorious against the Hutu-led government in Rwanda? How have they been able to do that?
Well, the difference between the Rwandan army and the Tutsi guerrillas is the Rwandan army is a classic despot army where drinking, rape, ill-disciplined renegade soldiers acting in a rampaging manner has always been tolerated and by some officers it seems encouraged. The Tutsi guerrillas, on the other hand, struck me as a highly professional, extraordinarily well-motivated, well-trained, and very professionally led guerrilla force. Just to give you an example, when I was in Rwanda, you'd see soldiers being very menacing at checkpoints. Foreign relief officials told me that they didn't like posting Western women near army bases because they were afraid they could become targets of rape. I visited a military hospital where soldiers who had been wounded several days before were suffering from an open femur fracture and gangrene, and I was told they weren't being treated because the doctors don't work weekends. Mm. So certainly this is not a very well motivated or disciplined force. The Tutsi guerrillas, on the other hand, I visited their base camp in Malindi during a ceasefire, and they were constantly marching and singing war songs and constantly maintaining their military ranks and military discipline. I mean, I guess it would seem like a boot camp to most lay observers, but certainly the Tutsi guerrillas always kept their forces in line. They didn't tolerate disobedience or renegade activity. And I think that certainly paid off now in the fact that they were able to organize their forces, to maintain their command structure, to be both mobile and at the same time to be able to concentrate forces to fight the government. And I think ultimately that's why they were able to defeat the Rwandan army. Let me also say, though, that observers who were familiar with both sides, including American intelligence observers, I think there was a consensus that the Tutsi guerrillas were far stronger than the Rwandan army. And when this conflict began, I think many people, and I was one of those people, expected the Tutsi guerrillas to take power much sooner than they actually did.
Well, I want to talk some more, but first we have to take a short break. And our guest on Fresh Air is Frank Smythe. He's a freelance journalist, also an investigative consultant to Human Rights Watch, their arms project. And we're talking about Rwanda. It's a country he has been writing about for some time now. We'll be back after a short break. This is Fresh Air. Frank Smythe is our guest today on Fresh Air, and he's a freelance journalist, and we're talking about Rwanda. Have there been stories or any evidence of abuses by the RPF in the last couple of weeks since they have moved into Rwanda from Uganda.
Well, there's certainly been charges that RPF guerrillas fired mortars indiscriminately and recklessly into Hutu civilians, killing dozens of them, as well as creating a stampede which killed dozens more. So certainly the RPF are guilty of human rights violations and the indiscriminate use of firepower. But overall, their human rights record is nothing like the rump government's.
What about the fact that there are now so many refugees in who are fleeing Rwanda? Do you think the Tutsis are responsible for that at all?
The Tutsis are certainly responsible for some of that. But the main reason that these Hutu civilians have such fear of the Tutsi guerrillas is they've been told that by the rump government over its ruling party radio. This is the same radio that incited Hutu militias to slaughter any and all Tutsi. Also was saying things that Tutsis were inhuman and, very strong racist propaganda. And not only were they inhuman, but if the Tutsi guerrillas come, they're going to kill you and your family and children. So you have to fight them. You have to fight them to the death. So when the Hutu civilians saw that their side, the Hutu militias, were losing to the Tutsi guerrillas, I think it was natural for them to believe this propaganda and to then presume that the Tutsi guerrillas would then kill them in revenge. I think that was a reasonable presumption on their part. And, of course, it triggered a mass panic of all these Hutus to flee in the Zaire. But there has been there's little evidence, although there were some abuses by the Tutsi guerrillas, there's little evidence that they have been killing Hutu civilians in revenge. But nonetheless, these Hutu civilians fear the Tutsi guerrillas because that's what they've been told and been led to believe by the propaganda coming out of the rump government's radio.
When you mention the rump government, what are you referring to?
This is the Hutu, what Belgium calls the Hutu extremists, the people whom allegedly assassinated the president and then directed the militias and as well as elements of the Rwandan army to begin killing both the Hutu opposition and any and all Tutsi civilians. Since the death of the president, these people declared an interim government with them in charge, and that's why I think the term rump government is appropriate.
And where are they?
They are now, some of them are in the safe haven created by France, and one of the problems is that the human rights community is asking France to arrest these people and to hold them so that they could eventually be tried in an international tribunal. Some of them have fled to Zaire and are now in Zaire near Goma.
And are these the people that the RPF are going to have to negotiate with in order to establish a coalition government?
The RPF has refused to negotiate with members of the rump government who are responsible for genocide. Instead, the RPF is going to have to find the moderate Hutu leaders who survived. And remember, there were several opposition parties, Hutu opposition parties, that first were created in the 1990s, which were both opposed to the hardline Hutus, but were quite independent of the Tutsi guerrillas. Many of these opposition party leaders have unfortunately been assassinated, but there are quite a few who have survived, and this is going to have to form the nucleus of a power-sharing agreement between the Tutsi guerrillas and these surviving Hutus.
Let me ask you, though, if Tutsis made up about 15% of the population in Rwanda, the numbers of people killed since April is anywhere between 200,000 and 500,000. How many Tutsis remain, you think, are still alive
in
Rwanda?
That's a very good question. Let me just add, certain State Department officials believe that the death toll may actually be higher, that the figure of 500,000 may be a conservative number, although it's very difficult to tell at this point. There are two groups of Tutsis that were involved in this conflict. One are the Tutsi civilians who have always lived in Rwanda, who were between, estimates run between 9 and 14% of the population. They have been largely wiped out. Most of them, it seems, have now been murdered. The other group of Tutsi involved in the conflict are the expatriate refugees, the individuals and their families who have lived outside of Rwanda since the 1950s. Most of these people have survived. But the problem is that the Hutu in Rwanda are very distrustful of them, not only because of the fact that they're Tutsi, but the fact that they've been living, most of them have been living in Uganda for the past 30 years. So there are Tutsi left in Rwanda, but basically the Tutsi that were there were mostly killed. And you have a new group of now repatriating Tutsi refugees that now I think probably comprise the majority of the Tutsi population in Rwanda.
UN Secretary General Boutros-Ghali called the world response to Rwanda a scandal. Do you agree?
Absolutely. I think it was an horrendous scandal. In addition to not doing anything in terms of trying to stop the genocide, the world was even reluctant, especially the United States, about calling it genocide. And I think that was that contributed to the violence. The Hutu extremists that are responsible for this violence carried it out with the idea that they could encourage the Hutu, the presidential guard, to kill the Hutu opposition, the militias to kill all Tutsi civilians, in the hope they could provoke some kind of popular, quote unquote, Hutu uprising against Tutsi, which would then leave both Tutsi civilians and guerrillas dead. And in the end, this block of Hutu extremists would be the only ones left standing, and they would then retain power in Rwanda. The world's reluctance and President Clinton's reluctance to call it genocide, I think, gave them the impression they can get away with this, as opposed to denouncing it in the beginning and saying, even if you succeed in killing all your enemies, we will bring you to trial and in an international forum for crimes of genocide.
Do you see, though, Rwanda as a test of world resolve in a post-Cold War world?
I think it's a test, but I think it's a very bad test. I think what we're seeing now, there's been this feeling after the Cold War that there's only one superpower. And I think what we're seeing now is countries like France asserting their power. And France's prime minister said in Paris on national television that one of the main reasons France is acting in Rwanda is to demonstrate that it is a world power. And I think what we're seeing is that instead of the world getting together under the guise of the United Nations and finding a collective response to the problem, which was necessary, I think what you saw is the world saying, well, if France wants to go in, despite the fact that it has a long association with the people doing the killing, and despite the fact that it may have an ulterior motive, we'll allow France to go in because no other country is willing to do the job. And I think that was simply a disgrace.
Well, Frank Smyth, thank you for joining us today on Fresh Air.
Thank you. My pleasure.
Frank Smyth has been covering Rwanda for The Nation, The New Republic, and The Village Voice. He's also an investigator for Africa Watch. I'm Marty Moscow-Wayne, and this is Fresh Air.